Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today are Trey Herr, who heads the cybersecurity program at the Atlantic Council Think Tank, and Will Loomis, who is part of the program as well. They are two of the four authors of a great new report, Breaking Trust, Shades of Crisis Across an Insecure Software Supply Chain. June Lee and Scott Stewart also contributed to the report. Trey and Will, thanks so very much for joining us. Great report.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having us.
I absolutely love how you started. Society has a software problem. That's hilarious, but it's also deadly serious because you guys illustrate vulnerabilities of what is a remarkably insecure software supply chain in virtually every aspect of society, whether it's national security or banking or commerce or transportation or manufacturing. You guys analyzed 115 attacks, 27 of those that came from nation states, including seven nation states that included some nations that we don't normally associate with as cyber threats, right? I mean, generally we think of China and Russia, not India, Egypt, and Vietnam. Trey, start us off, right? What are the threats and what's at stake?
So it couldn't be a bigger issue. When we think about software, it's in the laptop you're using, the equipment that we're talking over today with Zoom, it's in the cell phone, it's in cars that are mediating your interactions with the break. Software really has eaten the world, as we quote in the paper. And the problem for that is sort of twofold. The first is we depend on software for increasingly critical activities. And so how secure that software is, how well it works, is moving from a consumer technology problem to be a national security problem. It's stopped being about the blue screen of death, and it's started to be about whether or not I can get munitions to an F-35. Right? And the second issue is that the proliferation that we've seen, this explosion in the types of software and the places that software go, mean that the pipeline for code between a developer, somebody sitting there and actually tapping out the program, and the user has gotten longer and more complicated. And that pipeline, that supply chain of code is critically important because software, typically when it ships, is not all the way done, right? When you ship a car, you expect it to work completely, to be mostly free of defects, to function as a car. When you get a piece of software, we're all familiar with, the next day update, the next month update, something that adds a new feature or fixes an old bug or updates to protect against a newly discovered vulnerability. So that constant need to be pushing new changes and new code to software means that software supply chain is really critical. So we've got these two issues, software being used in places where we're really depending on it for critical functions, and this longer and ever more complex supply chain. And that was really the basis of the study, was to try and understand just how often are we seeing attacks and potential attacks against the supply chain. And as we found, these 115 incidents going back 10 years, it's more frequent than a lot of people know. And so for our purposes, trying to raise the profile of this issue and really highlight it as the national security issue that it is.
And one of the challenges, right, is, as we discovered in this pandemic, there are otherwise fully American companies that on closer examination have subcontractors of subcontractors that subcontracted out work to development labs, for example, in China or elsewhere, right? So you don't even have surety across shore supply chains of where the software is originating or all being coded from.
It's an interesting problem. So, I think the challenge is it's hard to assign trust based on nationality. There are open source projects widely used on the web, used by major defense department contractors that rely on open source code developed in the Netherlands or by a graduate student in Germany. And we don't assign less trust to those entities just because they're based outside the US. But the problem is that we don't often know who these entities are, and we don't necessarily have the expectation that they've got the resources to build something that could become dependent on by half the internet and secure over 5 or 10 years of its lifespan. So part of what we're trying to grapple with, and I think as we're talking about this, right, helpful to really think through the benefits and the negatives, trying to understand exactly how do we assure of some level of trust in these different relationships. Not to say, hey, this has all got to be code built in America, because that sort of, that approach, I don't think you're advocating, but certainly is a challenge in the supply chain debate. that kind of approach might stomp on a really great innovative ecosystem, right? The kind of low cost, high impact technology that enables really cool capabilities for the Defense Department for others in the US. So thinking about that balance becomes really important.
Will, let's break down the terms, because you do, guys, lay out a whole series of terms that folks might not be as you know, some of them are intuitive, others are a little bit less intuitive. So there are four of them. So if you could quickly help me out in sort of explaining to the audience what these things are and what they matter. So talk to us about breaking trust in code signing, what that means and why it's important.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that there are four key trends that we pulled out of the data set and really saw as key attack vectors for the various actors in the report. The first, as you mentioned a second ago, is breaking trust in code signing. So code signing uses public key cryptography and certificates to ensure the integrity of code. So basically this is saying that whatever piece of code that you're seeing is protected. It's from the company that created it, and that it hasn't been altered. And overcoming these protections, we noticed is one of the critical steps that enables actors to do everything from simple alterations of code to very complex nation state espionage campaigns. One of the most well-known examples of this is Shadowhammer. One of the other key attack vectors that we looked at were hijacked software updates. So, you know, this is just like any software update that comes across your computer. So one of those push notifications on your laptop that says, hey, Microsoft Word needs to be updated. This would be an example of that. So 27% of all the attacks in our database used a hijacked software update. And this is one of the key examples of how we break trust with these types of attacks. People really trust those updates. And when you insert malicious codes into those, it allows them to get out to sometimes millions of targets. And these are often, you know, parts of some of the most impactful software supply chain attacks out there. So Flame, NotPetya, and even CC Cleaner all use hijacked software updates in their payloads. The third one is open source code. So open source code and software is normally developed in a collaborative and public manner. And not proprietary in any way. And attacks that kind of poisoned open source code were really important because, you know, these allowed people to really hit a wide variety of code packages. So open source code is dependent on little short pieces of code, and there are packages all around the world that depend on those little bits of code. And if these codes are changed, there's really a wide blast radius of potential targets that can be affected by that single piece of code being affected. And finally, the last one and one of the most widespread attack vectors for users and kind of for the day-to-day individual is targeting app stores. So 22% of the total attacks in our database targeted app stores like the Google Play Store, like Apple's App Store, and other third-party hubs. And this allows them to spread malware directly to mobile devices. Some of these attacks also targeted developer tools. So the tools used by companies to actually create apps, which means that any app that was then created by that tool is potentially compromised. There are a bunch of examples of this, but one of the most well-known is Xcode Ghost. I think for this one, you know, it's very clear that these are, you know, hard to identify. They're hard to mitigate, and they're really all over the place. These are the four key trends that we noticed, and the four key attack vectors that actors used to get at people within the software supply chain.
You won the phrase of the program blast radius, which I've never heard in the context of a cyber interview. So you win that. You've brought the kinetic will into the cyber realm. Good on you on that.
Thank you. Yeah, we're always trying to bridge that gap.
So Trey, what now that we've you know, sort of defined the problem and outlined it, right? What are the concrete recommendations you guys are putting out so that governments, industry, as well as regular folks do a better job at this?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a tough problem. The overarching theme of the recommendations is collaboration. Private sector is not going to solve this on its own. Government's not going to solve this on its own. Developers are not going to magically fix this problem overnight. And a lot of the recommendations focus on organizational incentives, on changes in policy that are trying to drive or resource behavior. There's no one magic silver bullet. So three sort of top line things to take away. The first is it's too hard right now for a developer that doesn't have massive resources like a Microsoft or a Cisco to write code, write it well, and deploy it securely over years or even decades. It's too hard to do. And so a number of the recommendations call for policies and participation by the private sector to make tools which are effective, automated, and accessible to developers cheaper and easier to gain access to. And to line those tools up with what we see in the government, as well as in certain of the industry, as best practices in maintaining the security of the software supply chain. So thing one is make it easy. Second thing is trying to approach open source, not as a culture problem, but as a resource problem. Open source communities, and there really is no one open source community, but the broader ecosystem, which thinks in many different ways and has tons of different organizations, is typically under-resourced when you talk about individual projects, under-resourced to address software supply chain issues. So we call for both federal and private dollars to be better pushed into this ecosystem to give folks the chance to bring on the talent, to sustain the support, to buy tools in order to do this right. There are already programs out there that try to do this. The Linux Foundation runs the Core Infrastructure Initiative, which is a program started after many of your listeners may recall the Heartbleed incident of several years ago, where a vulnerability was discovered in this very widely used cryptographic package that supported more than 50% of web connections on the internet. And this was a project being run by a couple of volunteers and their dog, which is great and is classic open source, but is not what you would want to see for a really critical software package. And so the Core Infrastructure Initiative was an effort by private companies to take small amounts of money and push these towards high priority open source projects. We want to supercharge that, go from hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars, take, the list from 10 to 20 projects to hundreds, and to make resources accessible to developers who have a great idea, want to write a cool piece of code, but also need to consider the responsibility that code needs to be run and deployed securely for years.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
The third piece really is just that states have got to get serious about countering the high-end systemic threats. So, you called out, 27 attacks, distinct attacks in the data set coming from state actors. And we identify seven different state actors in the report. And this is undercounting, Fago. I mean, we are only using public information. We're only using, good, relatively solid attribution. We know we're undercounting how many of these instances are out there. We call on and we're looking for action by the U.S. to work with allies, especially in Europe, Australia, and Japan, to share information, to jointly investigate, and to bring to bear the resources and the expertise of these different security organizations to counter these kinds of attacks, not just because they affect all countries, but because they are so threatening to the technology ecosystem, right? If you don't trust your vendor, if you're not willing to hit update when Apple or Google sends you that notice that says, hey, I've got a fix for a security flaw on your phone or on your laptop, that is the ballgame. And so making sure that linkage of trust is incredibly strong and well protected, that's our focus.
And let me ask one last question. We've got about a minute left, and whichever one of you wants to pick this up. How do you make sure, right, because this is a collaborative network, and I know that you're trying to address that, Trey. But right, the person who is the open source software developer could not be who it is they portray themselves, or they may be working for a state intelligence agency, right? I mean, we found whether it's cryptographic gear, as you mentioned, software holes, right? Nation state intelligence services are remarkably good at buying the world's leading cryptographic equipment maker and then partnering with it for decades to compromise codes. Any one of our allies and partners can do that. Generally, if we're the guys benefiting from it, we tend to look at it beneficently. On the other hand, how do you do this trust piece of it when this is an industry that depends on individuals, it depends on openness, it depends on collaboration. And at the end of the day, it's very, very hard to police, in part because the community itself bristles at the notion of being policed or certified.
It's a big question. It's a lot to unpack in the last minute, but I'll just say this. There have definitely been, we've seen deliberate efforts to undermine these kinds of technologies. Cryptography is a great example. These efforts to undermine have led to loss of trust. They've also allowed, you know, years of attacks by people who can try to exploit weaker technology, weaker cryptographic standards. The problem is, or the problem we've got to confront, because it's holding us back in the U.S., especially on the security front, is that the U.S. has been responsible for some of these as well as our adversaries. And so it's a challenge right now, and it has unfortunately led to less progress than there could be on this really critical issue, where some elements of the U.S. government have to overcome this deficit of trust with researchers and with the tech vendor community because they've been caught out, unfortunately, right? And I think that they are in a position of having to sort of reestablish trust and really verify just how much they believe in the mission, this public good of securing the nation, which I think we all have great confidence that those organizations are focused on. So it's a huge problem. There's trust working on a couple of different levels, and we're still at the early stages, really, even though this is a debate that's been going on for 50 years, of how to establish trust in different systems, in hardware and software. And we're hoping that this report brings some focus back to software and makes a little bit of a dent in the discussion, but it's a fight that's far from over. So I'm sure we'll be back talking with you again before too long on this issue.
Trey and Will, thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Terrific work. Anybody who's interested in the report, go to the Atlantic Council website and you can find it. And really look forward to having you guys on again. Very educational. Thanks again.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.